Well, Frankie, now you have your master's degree from Northwestern, and then what happened?
Well, I continued to teach at the same school, Dunbar, but instead of being Dunbar High School, it was now Dunbar Grade School. And so I taught 7th and 8th grade. It became a K through 8th grade school. So I continued to teach homemaking in the 7th and 8th grade, and PE in the 7th and 8th grade. But I also taught music, art. I taught art and spelling and language arts and science and reading and whatever else did we have. And I did that until 59.
And that was the year you came to Decatur.
Right.
Well, now tell us how that happened.
Well, I came to Decatur because I had a friend or a couple of friends who lived here, the Russells. Joe was coach and Josie taught in the elementary school. And they had spoken highly of the teaching experience here. And it was a new venture, plus it sounded like it would be, if I could get a job here, that I wouldn't have to teach so many different things. Mm-hmm. I was teaching so many subjects after having been just a homemaking mm-hmm. teacher and who only taught homemaking and PE. To have to teach all these other things to so many different people. And I can remember I went also after I got my master's degree, I took a course in classroom procedures from the U of I in an extension class. Because, and I remember I wrote a poem, and I said, not much of me, as you can see, just 90 pounds, that is, less 3. And in this class, I teach a class of 41. And that was my class, 41. And so I entered that class to find out, how do you do it? So, it grew pretty hectic. So I applied to several places. I think I wrote to Lincoln, Illinois, and then I wrote to Springfield, and I wrote to Decatur, and I believe I wrote to Maryland, because I had some friends who lived in Maryland. And I heard from Decatur. And I ran across the letter that I had written when I applied at Decatur. And then I had a postscript. I said, after I'd given my qualifications, then I said, I neglected to say, I am a Negro. So, well, I thought that might be important. So
that is really sad, isn't it?
But it was important because they were looking for me.
They were, yeah. So that gave you the opportunity.
So.
Now, that was 1959.
Right. That was in July of 59 when I got the call from Mr. Gore to come for an interview. And I had a long talk with him. And then he sent me over to Johns Hill. They needed a teacher. And he said, I would prefer you're going to Centennial because they don't have a black teacher. They don't have a Negro teacher. They didn't use the term black at that time. But Johns Hill did have one. And so I would be the second one. So he was trying to get one in other schools. So I went to be interviewed by both principals. And I guess my interview with Mr. Rutherford did the trick.
Now, so which school was that?
That was Centennial. So I was pleased. I was impressed, mm-hmm. too. And then after I had been told I had the job, then apprehension set in.
On your part?
On my part. Because that was my first time. I had worked around, and in fact, during the summer, when I would go home during the summer, I would teach with, I sewed for a lady who was quite an illustrious personality. They had in Chattanooga, every summer, they would have what they called the Cotton Ball. And that was the rich people, the debutantes, making their debut. And she made the dresses, and all the dresses were alike, and with these hoop skirts, and it was the Cotton Ball. It was sort of like the Veil Prophet affair, you know, in St. Louis. And so I asked her, what should I do? I said, I'll be teaching class of 10% of the youngsters will be black. And my homeroom enrollment was 30, so I had 3 blacks in my homeroom. And I said, now, I'd just like to ask you, how would I discipline white youngsters? She said, the same way you discipline the black ones.
Smart
woman. She was very frank, yes. And she said, let me tell you, if you have a problem, or if you have any problem, don't proceed any further until you get that taken care of, she said, and treat them just like you would, just like you'd handle the blacks. And I was so glad that I had that talk with her, because I needed that. Because if I had tried to bend over backwards and treat them differently or better than I was treating the blacks, I would have had a hard way to go. And that's what many whites still have the problem, because they are so afraid that the black youngster will think that they are prejudiced. And they don't want them to think that they're prejudiced. So they go out of their way and overlook some of the things that they've done, many of the things that they've done. And I had one teacher to say to me, she said, but you don't know how many sit there and just stare back at you and just, you know, rolling their eyes and giving you the evil, I guess you might say. I said, but look how many whites I had looking back at me. So suppose I had allowed that to affect my handling any problem. And I didn't. And so I had a few problems, but not that many. Youngsters behaved for me, and so I had a good year plus the Parent Teachers Association was strong. And the first year, the lady who was the president, Mrs. Wilmoth, she was determined that because her daughter was in the class, in my homeroom, and she bent over backwards to see, she and all the other officers, to see that we had all the parents to come out to attend the meetings. Well, naturally, they were coming out to see who is this woman, who's this black woman coming to teach in this school.
Now, what class did you teach?
So I taught,
what courses did you teach?
I taught science. Mm-hmm. And the reason I taught science, I had given them my credits and for teaching homemaking. And they didn't have an opening for a homemaking mm-hmm. teacher. And so they had an opening for a science teacher. And he told, Mr. Gore told me, he said, I'm sure you can follow the book and handle the classes until you can get to a science workshop during the summer. Okay, I said, well, maybe I can get a workshop class at home this summer. I was in Chattanooga. And I tried, and they said, we don't accept colored. Mm-hmm. But do you know now they've got colored administrators?
Well, of course.
Same university, which mm-hmm. is now, it was at that time University of Chattanooga, mm-hmm. but now it's the University of Tennessee at mm-hmm. Chattanooga. But times have really changed.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes. So, the first, back to the PTA, they worked so well to get the parents out that each of the 9 meetings, the 9 months I was there, the PTA meetings, I won the trophy.
They gave a trophy.
They gave a trophy. It was a traveling trophy.
Can I get it?
Yeah. It was a traveling trophy that went to each class, you know, for the best attendance, the most parents. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, that's lovely.
So I received it. And I was
it's
so proud
a loving cup, isn't it?
Yes.
And it says PTA Attendance Award 5960. And at the bottom it says Miss Morgan 103.
That was a room number 103.
Well, very nice. Well, that's lovely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you had a good start then in Decatur.
I did. And I really enjoyed those youngsters. They worked very hard. They were an accelerated group mm-hmm. at that time, that particular homeroom. Although I had 6 classes, I didn't have a study hall. I had 6 classes, so they were really trying me.
Wow.
And with God's help, I made it.
You were lucky not to have a homeroom.
No, I had a homeroom.
You did have a homeroom.
I had a homeroom, but I also taught that homeroom.
Oh, you taught the homeroom.
Right,
as well,
right. And they were the mm-hmm. ones that were
well,
so...
how long did you stay at Centennial then?
Until they destroyed Centennial.
What year?
11 years.
11 years.
Until when I said destroyed, I feel that they disrupted so many lives mm-hmm. when they changed it to an experimental school, yes, a laboratory school, whatever, because they had just spent so much money to bring Centennial up to par, and to bring it into the fire code, you know, recommendations. And then they'd spent so much money improving the shop into thousands of dollars, I think around $38,000, with new equipment and that sort of thing. And they had a beautiful science lab that was just dismantled. I just hated to see that happen.
Well, where did you go from there?
So from there I went to Roseville. I stayed there 11 years.
Was that junior high or
yes.
high school? Junior high.
Junior high.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And taught?
I taught that.
Science?
Yes.
Did
yes.
you like science after you
Oh, yes. Through? After I had taught the year of science, I enjoyed it so much that when the opportunity came that I could transfer it to homemaking, I didn't want to. No. I didn't want to.
Did you prepare your students for the science fairs?
Oh, yes. And I've got quite a lot of pictures of their attending these fairs and that I'll show you. And we even went to the state to enter the Illinois Junior Academy of Science. And I had, on three different years, I carried youngsters there, and two of them, two different years, they qualified for the outstanding award. And so I was real pleased.
No, well, you should be.
I was real pleased.
Did any of them go on into careers in
and
science?
I was, yes, many have gone into the careers of science. And I was, for 1 year, 2 years, I was president of the East Central region of the Illinois Junior Academy of Science.
Very good.
And that was the year that I went to Roseville. 1 year, and so that was 79, I mean 69 and 70.
And you, then you stayed in Roosevelt the rest of your career and teaching career in Decatur.
Right. And a few summers, I think 4 summers, I taught special science to 5th and 6th graders. I enjoyed that. And the funny thing about Centennial. Now, I taught this summer class was taught at Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson was, it was considered to be in a better neighborhood than Centennial was. And I said, well, why can't I? Because I had to bring all of my equipment, because I had more equipment than they had over at Woodrow. So at my insistence, I mean, I had worried them, I guess, until they really had equipped Centennial very well. So I would have to bring all the equipment that I needed for that 6-week summer class over to Woodrow. And I said, why can't I have the class here? And then the year that they put in this new laboratory, I thought that would just be ideal to teach them there. And they thought that the parents of the youngsters who would be attending there would not allow them to go there. They wouldn't buy. And then they turned it over to them, you see. That's what made me see that what I couldn't believe their thinking, because they're over there now. Mm-hmm. And because it was not a free class, it was a paid summer class. Mm-hmm. I think they paid $30 to enter. but the kids thoroughly enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it with them.
Even with all the lugging of equipment?
Oh, yes. We took field trips, and and we did things. In fact, all my classes, when I began teaching science, I had them to experience things along with me, and we did things, you know, together. I ran across a picture of my first first experiment that the kids had ever done, and it was, I think, the volcano Kilauea.
The one in Hawaii.
The one in Hawaii that has been erupting almost yearly. Erupted, and we did an experiment, and the kids were able to see this and understand it, you know, and the assistant principal at that time took a picture. I took a moving picture of the activity in the class. So, well, they were thrilled.
Oh,
and from then on, it was, now they call it hands-on. But when I came, it was hands-on. But that was something.
Something that you introduced.
Right. They had never,
heard of that. They had the teacher doing
the teacher stood at the desk and did the experiment, and the kids watched it and wrote it up.
But that's not the same.
I think the reason I did that was because I had my experience in teaching homemaking, that we did things,
yes,
you know.
You learn by doing.
And I felt that's how the child learns, and so there was a lot of enthusiasm.
But
there was one teacher who thought we were just playing, and it brings to my mind this has nothing to do with teaching, but you'd ask about some of the experiences. During this time, I had always tried to teach the youngsters, in other words, to sort of not look, to see beyond my blackness, or to see beyond anybody else's blackness or whiteness, but just to see them as they were. And around 65, I think, or 66, they were trying to get this integration program really working, you know, and they had all kinds of workshops. At that time, they furnished us, they said, we've got all this money, if you don't even have to make your own bulletin boards, just whatever your idea, we'll have somebody here to do it. I said, what? Because I enjoyed making my own bulletin boards, and I used to have some beautiful bulletin boards. I'll show you some pictures of those. But at this time, I did escalate it to do something for me for Brotherhood Week, which was in February. And I would usually do something for Brotherhood Week, and then Black History Week was first, and then Brotherhood Week. And so she did. So I gave her my idea of what I wanted done. And she was quite an artist, so she wanted some hands, different color hands, joined together, you know. And so she was able to make these different color hands. And she said, oh yes, I can do that. And the first day we put those hands up, I was shocked to discover the next day I came back to school, the hands were gone.
Oh, the
black hand was gone.
Oh.
And so, she didn't make it black, she made it brown. So that hand had disappeared. So this was the first time I had a poem and what have you. So then I told her about it, and I said, I've lost my hand, and I figured some kid had come in there and had snatched down that hand. and I didn't know who to blame. And so she said, well, that's okay, I'll do it, I'll fix your number. So she fixed my number. That next day, the next morning, I came back, my hand was gone again. So I told the principal about it. And he said, oh, Miss Morgan, I just can't imagine how, what could have happened. Said, maybe, well, we thought maybe the janitor might have moved something, you know, we didn't know what. Anyway, he said, I tell you what, because this had happened on three different occasions before I told him. Then when I told him, he said, you let me talk to the custodian, and I don't want him to, I want him to lock the door. Said, you lock the door when you leave, and I want him to lock the door when he leaves from cleaning. So sure enough, the next morning I got there, the hand was crumpled in the wastebasket.
Was it the custodian?
Wait, no, no. It was the teacher next door.
Oh.
And he moved on to another place.
Oh.
But I had no idea.
Oh.
And so the principal was just shocked to discover that he had been, that just irked him that much. And then I started seeing things and reading things into what had occurred, because I used to, when I'd get a break, I'd go up into the library and use my time. I'd sit at a table, and this was the table I always sat at. And I noticed one time there was a piece of poster board, about just a little bit larger than this, and it was placed right on the table where I sat down. So when I took this seat, and it was a small table, about the size of a card table. And when I sat down there, this message was, it says, your kind of people. And a picture of some youngsters who was in one of my classes, where they had gotten in some trouble. They had stolen something or something, and the names were in there. And said, your kind of people, printed, your kind of people. And I thought, well now, why would they put that there? But really, at that time, I didn't think it was, you know, I had no idea. So then, another time, I came in the room, and somebody had put a can on my desk, and I took the top off the can. That was a bat. Well, I didn't know that much about bats, and I just like animals.
Mm-hmm.
I took the thing out and was carrying it around. As I said, God was with me, because that thing could have bitten me, and I would do something, you know, with a pencil or something, to let the kids see the teeth. I said, I want you to see how sharp these teeth are. Would you look? And I'd touch the thing, and the bat would bear open his mouth, and all these little needles. And we used it as a class. And then when I finished, I had them to take it outdoors and put it behind some bushes so nobody would bother it, and it took off. But that was put there to harm me.
But it helped you instead.
Yes, yes. So.
Well, why don't you tell us some more of the episodes that happened during your teaching career, some you especially remember.
Some time ago, when I go back in 1965 or 66, when the government provided us with extra money to give added experiences to the socioeconomically deprived youngsters, so to speak. I carried five classes to St. Louis to Grant's Farm, and they enjoyed seeing the animals and especially the Clydesdale horses. And of course, we didn't go into the brewery. We didn't go in there, but they saw all of the animals and enjoyed playing with them, the peacocks and the other birds, the exotic birds. The cockatoos, the talking birds, and the llamas and elephant, and oh, they just had a grand time. But I think the ones that intrigued them most were seeing the buffalo. They had never seen buffaloes. I had never seen any buffaloes close up, only on film. But they were interesting to watch. And then we went to Chicago. I carried my home room to Chicago, and to the Museum of Science and Industry. And we spent the day there. Of course, we had chaperones for every one chaperone for each eight youngsters, and that made it quite nice. They enjoyed it immensely. And we then I had a club, and I was able to carry my club out to the Redwood. That was before the old Redwood burned down. They had never been out to eat in such a fine restaurant.
You mean the Redwood Inn?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And that was the original one.
Yes.
And they enjoyed that. But soon after that, the money ran out. Mm-hmm. But at least they had a chance to enjoy some. So I've got pictures of those activities. And then one outstanding to my mind, it was outstanding event was when I had two classes, weather classes, to send up weather balloons. And we received an answer back from one. We had put postcards inside each weather balloon, and so we received a card back answering that from a man who had found it while he was out walking his dog. Mm-hmm. And the kids were thrilled.
Where did he find it?
He found it out near athletic field. Mm-hmm. While he was walking his dog in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Well, it went quite a distance.
It went quite a distance, yes. And it was such a terribly windy day that we had decided to launch them that I was really surprised that we had that result.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in 81.
A newspaper article,
yes,
about it, too.
Uh-huh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were all excited.
Are there any other episodes from your school that you want to tell us about?
Oh, one other time, we, in 76, when everybody was celebrating the bicentennial, one week I had youngsters to dress in old, early outfits. And so I did also, and I had a few who came in mm-hmm. dressed in the old antique clothes, and somebody from the newspaper office came down and took our picture.
Okay.
And we had a beautiful display in the showcase down the main hall with old antique pieces of equipment such as irons that were used for pleating, ruffling, that I had borrowed from the Peacock cleaners. And I also had an antique physician's case mm-hmm. with his instruments.
Where did you get that?
That was from Mrs. West.
Oh dear.
She was one of my parents, and she was also...
Was her husband a doctor?
Her father was a doctor.
Uh-huh.
Wetzel, Mrs.
Oh,
Wetzel.
Yes.
She let me borrow that, and I was so pleased to see some of the instruments that they used in those days, and it was so well kept. And we put that in the display case, and the kids were just thrilled to read about how he had used it. I believe it was during the, what did she say? I don't remember. I better not say which war, but it was might have been World War I that he had used those.
Uh-huh.
But
well, you had a wonderful teaching career.
Well, I did, and I enjoyed it up until the last day I taught.
Uh-huh.
And after I had retired, I hadn't planned to teach summer school, but I was asked to teach summer school because the person who had signed up to teach had changed their plans and mm-hmm. had decided to go to school themselves. And so the principal was distraught. He thought he was having a time trying to get somebody. I said, well, if you can't get anybody, I will.
Mm-hmm.
And I did.
Well.
So
you went beyond the call of duty.
Yes. And I got the nicest letter from him
mm-hmm.
As a result of having done that.
Well, how long ago did you retire?
In 81.
In 81.
Right.
So you've had a real taste.
I've had 4 years.
Of retirement.
Right.
And
right.
I'm sure.
And I've enjoyed it.
And all that has been just filled with activity.
Right. And I'm busier now than I was when I was teaching, and I don't understand it.
Well, one of your activities is gardening.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Now, could you tell us about your gardening? The kinds of gardening you do and where it is?
Well, I started off just having a small garden. At the time when I first moved here.
Here on Forest Street.
On Forest. I moved here just prior to teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed with the Russells until, I came, I guess maybe a week before school opened, and I stayed with them, and then they carried me around to look at places, and I happened to see this house, and the landlord was just taking the sign out of the window that said for sale. He had a for sale sign there, and he decided to let me rent it after I had seen it. I had been to several places mm-hmm. and I didn't like them, but I think I fell in love with that tree out there, that sycamore. It was such mm-hmm. it's such a big tree, mm-hmm. an old tree. And so there was an old shack on that side, and there was a vacant lot on on the west side that belonged to the house next door. But I only had just this plot to the back, which is just a 40-foot lot across the front. But it goes back over 200 feet.
And so that was your garden.
So there was a I discovered there was a garden there that by the people who had formerly lived here. And I was so glad because we'd always had a garden at home. My parents had always had a garden. My mother had flowers. She raised flowers, but my dad raised food in his garden. And so I had grown up with that. And I planted myself turnip greens and squash and peppers and tomatoes and things like that. And then the next spring I increased my garden because my neighbor across the street, who is deceased now, she used to raise some awesome, beautiful vegetables, and she got me to planting by the moon, you know, watching the moon. And she said, "Now you'll have," she said, "you'll find that you'll have better success." And then I was growing a sweet potato.
Excuse me, did you? Scientifically. You won't say scientifically, but
well,
you did have better success.
It had something to do with it. It really did.
So you agreed.
So I agreed. From then on, I would not plant if the almanac didn't say, if the almanac said don't plant, I didn't plant.
Well, for coming from a science teacher, that means something.
Yes. So I used to grow sweet potato vines just for decorative purpose. And she told me, she says, "Why don't you plant those, Miss Morgan?" And she said, "Just pinch off those, each of those slips." And I had, oh, just worlds of it, you know, had a, quite a long, it had made quite a large vine. And I broke those off and planted them. And I was so thrilled to get sweet potatoes coming out of the ground.
To the vine.
Right, right. So then I passed it on to the children the next year and showed them how to do that. We used to, I used to have them make gardens in milk cartons.
Oh, yeah.
And they, I've got some pictures of some of their gardens that they would grow and then take home and transplant them. And my mother said, "Who ever heard of anybody transplanting corn?" I said, "It can be done." And they enjoyed it.
Then you started with flowers.
Yes. So my mother always had rose bushes, beautiful large roses. So I bought myself 3 rose bushes. And I was just so thrilled with my roses, and I found out later how they were so small, you know. I didn't know I guess it just never dawned on me that I needed to feed them extra food. And so a teacher who later moved away, and I heard from her this Christmas, invited me to join the Rose Society, the Stephen Decatur Rose Society. And I think she asked me because she felt sorry for me. My roses were so pitiful. So I was so proud of them, but they weren't what they should have been. And I joined. That was in 66. And that was a year also that I was asked to join American Association of University Women. So I joined those two organizations, and I've been a member ever since. And then after learning how to grow roses better, I kept increasing my garden Until now, I have over 100 rose bushes.
Oh, beautiful.
At the same time, I'm also a rosarian.
What does that mean?
That means that I've been given a certification as being a rosarian, and supposed to be able to give out advice.
Oh, yes. And authority on roses.
Consulting rosarian. And then I became a rose judge.
Oh, good.
That was judge of horticulture. Mm-hmm. And then last year, last fall, '84, I became an arrangement judge. Mm-hmm. And
where did you learn arranging?
I first went to Springfield Garden Club. I'm also a member of Springfield Civic Garden Club. And through them, I entered the flower show school. And you go for it, that it takes 3 years, or rather it's a time lapse of 3 years, because you go for 3 days. It's a sort of a concentrated session. And then with your studies, you go that spring and then the fall of the, you can go in the spring and fall of each year. And then you have to have completed 5 flower show schools sessions. And then you take an examination, and then you become an accredited judge after you finish your examination. During the time you are studying, you have to judge as a student judge. You have to judge 5 shows, and then you have to gain or merit 5 blue ribbons.
So it really is an honor when you receive the full award.
Yes.
So
then I became a National Council of State Garden Clubs judge, and that helped me to become an arrangement judge for roses. Mm-hmm. So I've been so right.
Well, now, are roses your only flower interest?
No.
What else?
I like anything that grows. And I've got, I think my next love would be herbs. Mm. I've started raising quite a few herbs. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you, did you come to our flower show?
I know, I'm sorry, I missed that.
Well, I had a...
Are herbs considered flowers?
Yes.
They are.
Yes, well, they are. But, of course, I don't grow them for the flowers. Mm-hmm. I grow them because when I exhibit herbs at the state, they can't have flowers on them.
There's a separate category for herbs.
Right. Mm-hmm. And these are the culinary herbs for cooking or mm-hmm. for potpourri, that sort of thing. But, of course, any plant that does not have a woody stem is considered an herb. But, yes, but these are especially for seasoning spices and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind I have started growing. And I enjoy it.
You have received awards for other flowers?
Yes.
What are some of those?
This past fall, I received an award of merit for growing a gardenia plant that's in my bedroom window. It's probably 23 years old. It's over 20 years old. And It's full of buds now.
Oh.
And it was not in full bloom. It just had a lot of buds, and it only had one open bloom, but mm-hmm. they gave me an award of merit because of how healthy it looked. Uh-huh. So I've done quite well with my African violets. I didn't do too well this time. I just got second place ribbons. But I have received first place ribbons on my violets.
In the past.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this table is filled with ribbons.
Well,
some of them.
Yes, they're for all sorts of things. Some will say, I like that one. That one says Princes of Arrangement. That was for a rose. That was second place for a rose arrangement. No, that's for floriculture, because it said floriculture.
Royalty Award Queen of Arrangement.
Yes.
So that was first.
That was first.
It's
that was the top. Yes. I've got two of those. That's for roses.
Have you received some of these for other flowers?
Yes. Now, I think that one, what does that, that's it? That says for butter, I think.
Oh, you expand your activities to food?
Right. This was the, I've got the best of butters.
But
in other words.
You mean you make butter?
Oh, yes. I made, this was apple butter.
Oh, I see.
And there were other classes entered at the fair. There was peach butter and there was another butter, peach butter and strawberry butter. I'm not sure what other kind of butter, but anyway, there were some other butters other than the apple butter. Mm-hmm. I got first place for the apple butter, and then they checked against the first places of these other butters. Mm-hmm. And mine was the best of all
the best
of the butters.
Show. Well,
so
great.
That was in 1983.
Very good.
And then I've got a best of all relishes.
Oh, great.
In over there against the wall. That one, I think, that's best of all relishes.
Culinary best of relishes.
Yes.
Well, what kind of relishes?
Now, the relishes, they had pickles. They had... Mm-hmm. They had pickled beets, and they had pickled sweet pickles, the gherkin type, and then they had all kinds of relishes.
Like piccalilli,
yes. And then you could make your own relish. And of course, this one, I made a relish that had in it carrots. It was called Golden Glow.
Oh.
And it was colorful, quite colorful.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then, of course, they open them up and taste them.
Yeah.
So evidently...
It was good tasting.
It was. Uh-huh. It really was. So that was in 82. Uh-huh. So then...
you are very busy in the summer.
Yes, yes. And sometimes I work out in the yard all until dark, from early morning till... It gets dark.
And you must work in the kitchen, too, then.
Yes.
You got all these things ready.
This year, though, I did not, except for the county, I didn't do any state fair showing of any food, because I said it really was a waste of food unless I don't entertain that much. And to make the pickles and things, the year before, I think I believe I entered 15 cans of different things. The beans and the canned beans and the canned tomatoes, they don't open. But things like peaches, they didn't open the peaches, but they would open the jellies and the the butter.
So it would really be spoiling.
And the relishes, yes. It was just a waste. And
after all, Frankie, you ought to give some other people a chance.
Well, I decided I wouldn't enter anymore. So I said I had received the top award, so I just let somebody else.
You can rest on your honors.
So now I'm trying to get top awards for my arrangements. The arrangement classes pay more because, like, for first place for a floral arrangement brought $15. And a table brought $16. This past year, they increased the price, so it was $18. And I got a Revere Bowl.
Oh,
1 year, the big
beautiful
Revere Bowl over on the end.
That's beautiful.
And then I got a silver compote for best arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
In 83, I think. And the tree back there, the faculty gave me when I retired, that tall tree.
Without giving us a lesson, could you tell us a couple of basic points of arrangement that people ought to watch?
Well, some of the basic principles that they should watch would be, of course, the first thing you need would be, they've got to have line material. And they don't have to have many flowers. They can make an arrangement with a few flowers. But they would need something to carry out the line.
The eye from one place
from
to the
one other. Place to the other. And to carry it through to the tip, from the base to the tip. And it should be balanced, and to find out how to get the balance. They have a visual line, and it should be the same amount of weight on both sides. It doesn't have to be equally, it doesn't have to be symmetrical. It can be, it can have a different sort of flower or leaf on one side or another, but you can visually imagine an imaginary line down the center and decide which is it too heavy on one side or too little on one side. And it would be sort
well,
of hard to do
lesson,
to without showing. But I have learned the hard way because I have put things together. And so much so that when I first started, I first began to enter flowers at I entered roses at the county fair in 1972. And I got my first ribbon. And I was so pleased that I decided I was going to try to enter the state fair. And so I sent in my application and entered the state rose. They have a rose day, and I entered then. And mother thought that was so foolish for me to try to compete with them, with people from all over the state, you know. So I said, well, I'm going to try. And so in 73, I got my first blue ribbon.
Oh, good.
And that was for a single rose called Dainty Best. It's a hybrid tea, but it's single. And then I had already gotten my first blue ribbon when I entered the first rose show in horticulture. Now I don't enter horticulture because I use all my roses to make arrangements.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Well, you really have had a wonderful career, not only in teaching, but in flowering and gardening and flowers and so on.
Yes.
But you have another talent.
What's that? Oh.
You're singing.
That is my main talent. That's my God-given talent.
I know. And as I told you, you've described as singing like a lark.
No.
Tell me, have you always been singing?
Yes. I always sang. And I guess I probably got it from my mother because she, well, my dad had a lovely voice too. He used to sing in the choir. And my mother would sing. I would hear her singing while she was hanging up clothes. And one of her neighbors said, "I just don't see how you can sing with all those clothes." She said, "I counted those shirts," and it seems like she had counted 20-some shirts hanging up on the line. She said, "I don't see how you can sing with all that work." But she did.
Well, maybe the singing helped her.
Oh, it did. Uh-huh. It did.
Well, now, did you have lessons?
Well, I had lessons in college, a few lessons in college, and then, but never anything serious. Then I decided I would try to, after I was out of school and I was working in a beauty shop, I decided I was going to try to pay for lessons. And it was $3 for 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so I tried that for a month and I couldn't afford it.
Did it help you?
It helped me some. Uh-huh. It helped me some. Uh-huh. But I got more help really from having sung in the courses in college.
Did you always, in high school or younger, did you sing in choirs
and courses? Yes. And my mother's friends said they would have me going, mother would have me going around singing. And one of the songs I used to sing was My Wild Irish Rose. Mm-hmm. And the reason I was singing My Wild Irish Rose, my dad had found that music on the floor of the car when he was sweeping the train. And he found this music and brought it home, and I learned to play it.
Did you have a piano?
I took piano lessons, yes.
You had a piano in
your
home.
And I hated piano lessons. Well, I didn't start out hating it. I began taking piano when I was 6 years old. And then my piano teacher died. And I was really making strides, leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. I was just doing so well. And I think maybe I just couldn't understand that, her dying like that. And she was such a gentle person and so nice. Then the next music teacher I got was the kind who, if you hit the wrong note, she tapped you on the fingers.
And
I was forever hitting the wrong note, I'm sure. Anyway, I grew to hate it.
Oh.
And
you didn't want to get
done. I didn't,
done.
No, mm-hmm. no. But a couple years ago, I said, now, I believe I'll get myself, if I had something, because I